The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Picture this. You're at the supermarket, ready to check butter off your shopping list. You head over to the dairy aisle and see a few brands, Land O'Lakes, Organic Valley, maybe even Kerrygold for those special occasions. And of course, butter substitutes. No big decisions to face there, right? Well, food writer and former pastry chef Elaine Kosrova argues that butter is much more nuanced than the grocery shelves may lead us to believe, both in flavor and in history. Her new book, Butter, A Rich History, tells the story of this humble kitchen staple from the ancient butter bogs of Ireland through the butter margarine wars to the present. Elaine Kosrova, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So if I were to rely only on the butter found in the supermarket shelves, what am I missing?
Well, you know, the nuances you just referred to is a fairly new phenomenon in the butter market in this country. Post-war, we had a lot of industrial production, and so the standard was to create the exact same kind of butter every day. And so cow diets were standardized, and, you know, the butter making in these big plants was very routine. And so we got butter that was virtually the same from place to place, region to region. And that's really shifted in the last 10 years. There's much more artisanal production, for one thing, but even the big guys, the big producers, are doing higher-fat butters, they're doing cultured butters. So we're actually returning to the kind of nuances and variety in butter that existed centuries before.
And even millennia. How long have humans been making butter?
Oh, gosh. You know, we'll never know exactly, but we know for sure that the ancient Sumerians who lived in 2500 BC made butter. They have temple carvings showing churning. But it probably followed domestication, which is at least 9,000 years old. And it more than likely started with sheep and goat as well, not cows. That was much later.
Did those early butters, did they look or taste or bear any resemblance to these neat little sticks we have in our refrigerators?
Probably not, because for one thing, they didn't have refrigeration. And so there would have been a lot of fermentation of the milk. Generally, back then, they wouldn't be skimming the cream off the top as we do now to make butter. They would make butter from whole milk. And generally, it was quite fermented, like a yogurty type of product. So those butters definitely had a tanginess. I doubt that there was much salt in them, or else there would be a lot of salt if they were going to preserve them. So they were really quite different in taste and texture and look. If you see a goat butter, you know, even now, but goat and sheep butter, they're white. They're not even yellow.
Well, you traveled really all around many parts of the world to look into butter, including the Cork Butter Museum in Ireland. What did you find there?
I found what I call my holy grail. It was a 1,000-year-old piece of bog butter that's on display.
What is bog butter?
So bog butter is butter that was made, you know, in this region we now call Ireland. But 1,000 years ago, people made it, and, you know, it sustained them in many ways, nutritionally and medicinally. But to preserve the butter, they often put it in the bog because the bog is very anaerobic. You know, there's not a lot of spoilage that happens in the bog. But they also put it there as a sacrificial offering to the fairies and the elementals, who they believed really controlled what happened in the churn. You know, butter was very mysterious for many thousands of years. Without the science to explain how this liquid yields these beautiful golden pieces of butter, people really were astonished, and there's a lot of superstition that grew up around butter making.
That looks like magic.
Right, exactly.
Well, and it was also part of spiritual life in many different cultures. Maybe you could go through some of those Tibetan butter sculptures.
Yes. Chapter 3 in my book, I go into a lot of detail. This was really surprising to me to find that across the board, butter was this kind of revered, sacred tool used for a lot of different rituals. And even today, it's still being done. And Tibet is a good example of that because the Tibetan Buddhists make these sculptures called tormas, which are essential to their practice. So if they have a prayer festival, they will create these beautiful, magnificent, detailed displays of butter sculptures representing different deities. And they also use the butter. Typically, it was yak butter in Tibet. They use it to create many, many small little butter lamps, and these represent illumination in a metaphysical way. And there are also lots of different practices just socially. When you greet a person, for instance, in parts of the Himalayas, you smear butter on their head and chant three blessings. That's just one part of the butter world that, you know, really honors butter in many ways.
Well, you might see butter sculptures still at state fairs, but I think the whole smearing thing didn't translate.
Yeah, right. Yes.
Well, it's also, it turns up in the very first meal mentioned in the Bible. The Hindus make copious references to butter's sanctity. What, you know, besides this kind of transformation, what do you think accounts for this kind of connection between butter or in the spiritual or the ritual?
I think most of it's rooted in the fact that butter was seen as sort of this purification of milk. You know, you would take the milk from the cow and then churn the milk and yield butter, and then in many of these places, such as in India and parts of Asia, they would then boil the butter down to make ghee, and ghee, which is a butter oil, represented sort of, you know, this very ultimate product. You know, it really represented something refined and holy.
Think butter is just for spreading on bread? Well, think again. Elaine Korsova is with us, and she's talking about her journey really all around the world to find the deeper meaning of butter. She's the author of the new book called Butter, A Rich History. Okay, so of course, we have to talk about margarine making the scene, which happened much earlier than I thought. Tell us a little bit about that history.
Yes, it was in the late 1800s. The story goes that Napoleon III, he needed to feed his army, and butter was very expensive. So he put out a call for a sort of contest for someone who could come up with a substitute for butter for his to feed his army. And a chemist came along and discovered that by blending beef fat with milk and coloring and a little bit of salt, he could approximate something like butter. So the early margarines were nothing like the margarines that we know now that are made with hydrogenated vegetable oil. And so that was in the late 1800s. It wasn't really until post-war that we started to create, you know, the vegetable oil-based margarines that are now all over the marketplace.
Margarine was certainly cheaper, but a lot
right.
of people for many years thought that it was actually a healthier option. When did margarine become the better way to eat?
Margarine became the better way to eat primarily when we started demonizing saturated fat, because saturated fat comes primarily from animal products, and butter has quite a lot of saturated fat. So margarine could boast the fact that it was made from vegetable oils and was full of polyunsaturated fat. And so that's how margarine became so popular among health experts.
When did that turn around, when recognizing that good quality fat was good for us?
You know, it's pretty recent. Of course, there were fringe people who never really bought into the fact that margarine was good for you because it was such a synthetic product. But it's really, I would say, in the last 10 years that, you know, given the health of our country and obesity epidemic and diabetes issues, you know, that we've really reexamined the whole saturated fat cholesterol issues related to heart disease and other illnesses. So butter is finally getting redemption, but, you know, it's way overdue. And it's still, you know, in the New York Times yesterday, there was even an article that said, yeah, butter's back, but be careful, and then went into this whole tirade about saturated fats. And the fact is that saturated fat world, we now know, is very, it's vast. There's all these different kinds of saturated fats, and they do different things in your body. So it's pretty exciting times for butter.
Well, Elaine, the artisanal movement, it's really changed what we see at the grocery stores. You know, artisanal bread and cheese, standard fare now. But butter, not so much. Why not? And do you think that will change?
Well, I think you really have to go to smaller markets. You have to go to smaller food shops, more boutique food shops, and farmers markets. Those are great places to find artisanal butters. I know in my area, if I go to my supermarket, I won't see any of those artisanal butters. But we have a food co-op and another little farm store down the road, and I can find some interesting local butters. They're usually, you know, in and out of season. So I think they're still on the fringes. They probably always will be to some degree, but they're becoming more and more common.
Elaine Korsova, she's a former pastry chef, food writer, and lover of butterfat, and author of the new book, Butter, A Rich History. Elaine, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
The book also does include some great butter-centric recipes, and you'll find some of them on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. In the Northeast, you may know them as Jimmies. Other people may fondly refer to them as funfetti, rainbow sprinkles, or unicorn food. Those brightly colored sugar candy pieces that crown cupcakes, sugar cookies, ice cream sundaes, and in Australia, inexplicably, toast. They may seem out of place in a world that currently embraces the natural, the organic, and eschews the artificial. But turning food into a festive rainbow explosion has become decidedly highbrow. Julia Moskin is a New York Times food reporter who looked into the current funfetti explosion. Julia, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So these rainbow sprinkles, they've been around for a while, but I guess they really took off in the 90s. So for those who don't know about it, the funfetti cake from Pillsbury, can you describe it?
Exactly. I myself was not a child at this time, but people who might be called millennials were children at this time. And this cake mix was introduced in 1989, and it was the first time that someone had thought to put these sprinkles in the cake rather than on the cake. And what happens, of course, for those who don't know about it, is that in the oven, these sprinkles melt into these beautiful streaks of color. And if it's frosted with white frosting, which it usually is, and you cut into it, and then there is certainly what you might describe as a rainbow explosion. And of course, to kids, this was irresistible. One person I talked to said it was as if chocolate and vanilla had just ceased to exist, and funfetti was everything.
Not that you need a lot of tricks to feed kids cake, but I guess this really worked. So we're seeing a kind of resurgence of this funfetti aesthetic. Is social media the catalyst for these kind of food trends?
It is a huge part of it because, of course, the same people who had funfetti birthday cakes are now people who are constantly on Instagram and Pinterest. Some of them, of course, have become home cooks. Some of them are pastry chefs, like Christina Tosi, who is the chef at Milk Bar. And she was really the first person to kind of bring back the rainbow sprinkles in the cake as kind of a more high-end thing. Her birthday cake and her birthday cake truffles are the most popular product at her bakery. And her cookbook has influenced a whole generation of bakers. And she also does things like cereal milk panna cotta and other kind of what in the food business we call high-low combos. And that is something that people really love.
So the kids that used to have funfetti cakes when they were little, now grown up running bakeries and kitchens, is this a generational thing?
I think it absolutely is. I also spoke with a cupcake baker, the owner of Sprinkles Bakery in Los Angeles, which is very popular. There are 20 stores and 12 cupcake ATMs. And she said that when she started out in 2005, and she is also not a member of the Funfetti generation or the Funfettials, and she said that she really didn't want to use rainbow sprinkles, that she thought they were kind of like supermarket cupcake decorations. And she wanted something more modern and more elegant. And now the pendulum has kind of swung back to like, come on, they're just fun. And they're so retro. They're really nostalgic for this generation. And of course, now you can be so creative visually. So here's the thing about Pinterest is that, you know, normally you make waffles, you make sugar cookies, you make pancakes, they're brown, they're golden brown. that's pretty much the range. But people make funfetti pancakes, people make funfetti waffles, people make funfetti martinis, people make funfetti dessert nachos. And the way that that shows up on social media is wow.
Okay, dessert nachos. I've seen pictures of bagels, grilled cheese. Really?
Everything, even in a high-end restaurant that I went to, certainly what you would describe as a farm-to-table restaurant in the heart of Brownstone, Brooklyn, I was served a cheese course, which was a slice of gorgonzola, a very expensive blue cheese from Italy, that was crusted with rainbow sprinkles.
Did it make it better, Julia?
No. In that case, it did not work. But also in Brooklyn, there is a kind of ironic hipster diner where they make their own rainbow sprinkles, which is truly an insane thing to do. They pipe thin lines of colored icing onto sheet pans, let them dry, and then break them up into sprinkles. And those are actually delicious. And it turns out that you can flavor them and you can color them the way that you want to. So that's an example of a kind of artisanal sprinkle that does work. However, you can't make funfetti cake out of anything with natural coloring. So it really has to be the full artificial dyes, exactly what you want. But I think the idea is that, you know, once a year, it's a dark time in our nation's history, whatever, it's time for a little bit of funfetti.
Julia, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Julia Moskin, a food reporter for The New York Times, and she wrote the article, The Funfetti Explosion. You'll find a link to read it and, better yet, to look at all the pictures at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Winter is coming. It's getting steadily colder and darker, and the nation is still reeling from a presidential election that pretty well split voters down the middle. Maybe a good time for a healing bowl of soup.
When I think about being sick as a child, I think about my mother bringing me a bowl of soup.
That's cookbook author and Here and Now's official chef, Kathy Gunst.
There was something about soup as medicine, soup as healing. You have to take your time with it. It's very hot. You want to blow on it. You kind of take a moment of taking it in, and then you have your first slurp, and you spoon it in, and it's a food that requires some thoughtfulness.
For Kathy, that kind of appreciation is not a solo experience. It's meant to be shared with friends and loved ones. And that's the gist of her new book, Soup Swap: Comforting Recipes for Making and Sharing. And if that sounds a little too kumbaya to you, Kathy would be the first to admit she is not a fan of the potluck.
If you invite me to dinner, I would really like you to cook it for me, okay? I don't want to bring the main course to your house. I'd rather have you come to my house and give you the main course.
It all started about 6 years ago when Kathy's friend Hope called and proposed a soup swap. One person hosts, makes the salad, the bread, and the dessert, and everyone else brings a pot of soup. Kathy thought, that sounds like a potluck.
And I'm thinking, I'm not in. No. And then she says, and then at the end of the party, we go home with six different types of homemade soup, all the leftovers, and you're not stuck with that same pot of soup all week long. Then I started to get interested. I'm thinking, all I have to do is make one pot of soup, and I go home with six. So do the math. It works. It's a win-win. So we started
half a dozen years later, the monthly soup swappers are still rotating hosting duties among a group of 12. None of them vegetarians, which was by design.
We didn't want to have to always be thinking, oh, will she eat that? Oh, does he eat that? So I highly recommend that you do this with like-minded cooks. You know, really, I mean, a vegan soup swap, awesome. Just not for me. I'm going to get in trouble for that.
Soup, Kathy says, carries a story. So the group has made a tradition of telling an origin story before they sit down to eat. It's a way of acknowledging the work and also helps bring the group together, physically and culturally.
So we would go around the room and I might say, I made matzo ball soup because this is what we always had for Passover, and my mother-in-law taught me how to add seltzer to matzo balls to make them really light and fluffy. Yeah, great tip. Or you might say, I made Hungarian mushroom soup because my grandparents came from Hungary and my grandmother always used to make this for me when I was a little girl, and I found four types of mushrooms in the market. And someone else might start to tell us about how they just took a trip to Vietnam and tasted their first pho. The soups become storytelling.
I think my story might be, I was raised on Campbell soup from a can. My mother opened up the can, put it in a saucepan with that big and then heated it up.
And I bet you 90% of people listening to you are nodding their heads going, me too. The same. I grew up on tomato soup from Campbell's. Thank you very much. I thought that was our last name. Okay, now I'm going to cry because the shallots are so fresh.
That idea of hosting a soup swap as the weather gets colder is so inviting, but finding culinary inspiration can be a little bit daunting. So I visited the James Beard Award-winning cookbook author and Here and Now's resident chef at her home kitchen in southern Maine on a raw fall day to get some one-on-one soup-making tips. The first thing she wanted to do was dispel a common myth that soup is only good for starters.
Soup is not always a snack or a first course. When you put love and time into it, it can be your main course. So we are going to have a Thai red curry chicken noodle soup. In about 15 minutes, this kitchen's going to smell like a Bangkok market on a rainy Maine day. But we're going to start by just chopping some shallots and getting those cooking.
And Kathy was right. In just a few minutes, there were rich smells of ginger and turmeric and curry filling her kitchen. And as the shallots cooked, Kathy gave me some soup tips. Number one, make funky toppings.
So one of the things I found writing this book is that by doing a few really simple things like chopping herbs or grating cheese or making croutons from polenta or whirling up some chives and olive oil for like a chive pesto, and these very simple kind of toppings for soups can elevate a soup from kind of like yum to wow, what is this? So the shallots are going to be a bit of a topping. I'm crying from the onions. Give me one second. I should wear my onion goggles.
Do you have onion goggles? Tip number two, you got to have the right equipment. In this case, onion goggles.
Look at these.
Oh my God.
I know, you need a picture. This is the best.
I'll take it. Hang on. Tip number three has to do with what Kathy calls the S word, stock.
It's enough for people to think about making soup, but if you start talking about stock, they really become terrified. It's like, you know, you've said, well, you're going to perform brain surgery and it'll be fine. But so what I try to explain to
Kathy says she throws a couple of raw chickens, some vegetables, and spices into a pot.
I cover it. I put it on low. I walk away and live my life. And an hour and a half, 2 hours later, I have this gorgeous, rich pot of chicken stock that I can then freeze. I can use it for a soup today. I can use it for a soup in February. It's not that scary. Let me turn the TV.
Tip number four, for soup with noodles or rice, you want to cook them separately.
If I were just to throw the noodles in, it would just suck up all the broth and we'd have this gloppy mess. So I always cook rice, orzo, any kind of pasta separately, undercook it slightly, and then I add it to the soup.
While we spoke, Kathy moved effortlessly around the kitchen, giving a little stir to the simmering flavors, pouring steaming pots of stock into a strainer, and making me a cup of tea. Her final tip doubles as a metaphor for good company. You let the soup sit. It gets better with time.
Right now, these ingredients are strangers to each other, right? They're just getting to know each other. But in a few hours, they're going to be good friends. And tomorrow, they're going to be really good friends. So the sitting with the soup is almost always a good idea, even if you only have a few hours. But it's really nice to give it time to kind of let the flavors emerge.
Kathy is a devotee of the soup swap, not just because she loves to cook and because she's a Yankee now and really likes to bring home leftovers, but because food has a way of bringing people together. And whether you're talking about a good recipe or a good gathering, that sort of quality takes some time to grow. As for the Thai red curry chicken noodle soup, I will say it was delicious right out of the pot. And I should say, I'm not a fan of that radio reporter tastes or chews or slurps food and then says, mmm, on the air. Some things are just better experienced in person or face-to-face.
So do you think having soup swaps might be a good way to heal the partisan divide?
I wish. If only the partisan divide could be fixed. But if anything can do it, yes, soup. Time to get your soup on.
Kathy Gunt's new book is called Soup Swap, Comforting Recipes for Making and Sharing. And we posted the recipe for Thai red curry chicken noodle soup from the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
How much soup can you eat if everybody's bringing these big pots of soup?
Well, the idea is that you don't have a huge pot. We use little ramekins and tiny little bowls. When you're at a soup swap, you just taste what you want to taste in any order. And then everybody's like, oh, you got to try her tomato soup, or you got to try this Thai curry soup, or oh, his fish chowder is amazing. And a lot of comparing notes, maybe like a wine tasting.
Before it was embraced by celebrities, chefs, and an estimated 16 million Americans, veganism meant radicalism, like the animal rights activists who throw red paint on women wearing fur, a tactic picked up by the Sex and the City movie.
Fur is murder!
Murder! Murder!
A number of vegans have labored to distance themselves from that image, setting off a schism that has divided the movement for 15 years. One camp follows an all-or-nothing imperative to eliminate the commodification and consumption of animals and animal products. The other is working to make strategic, incremental changes in food policy, production, and preferences. Chase Purdy is a New York-based journalist who writes about food for Quartz. That's where we found his article about the divergent paths of the vegan movement. And Chase, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So a shift within the vegan movement started stirring in 2000, then this split in 2001. What was behind it?
So what was really behind that was for at least three decades, the vegan movement really sort of was one note in many respects. People who drove this movement had a very sort of specific ideology that it was either, you know, it was a black and white, either no animal products or animal products. People need to make a choice, and it was a moral imperative to choose living life without these animal products. And about seven people in 2000 basically thought that they could accomplish more by approaching this differently. And so it started with them. They were mostly in Washington, D.C. They were all friends, and they decided to approach the vegan movement with the idea that they would be able to accomplish more by driving for incremental change.
And incremental change meaning what?
Meaning that, well, for starters, that instead of focusing on so many different areas in veganism, like the fur fashion industry and how animals were used in labs, they would focus on one thing, farm animal welfare. The idea behind that was that most animals in the United States are part of the farm animal system. And so by driving for policy changes at the state and federal level, that they would be able to do the most good for the most animals.
By getting people to eat less meat?
That's part of the strategy, yes. You know, there are a few examples of this that come to mind, and that is in 2008, there was a ballot measure in California that was going to basically change the requirements that egg farmers had for the sizes of their cages. That measure passed in California with overwhelming support. In February of 2014, the Humane Society, which is a major player in this effort, partnered with the United Egg Producers to try and put in the U.S. Farm Bill a provision that would also tackle some requirements for cage sizes for laying hens. Fortunately for them, didn't really work. It got torpedoed by other interests at play. But it's another example, this time on the federal policy level, like how they're driving for change, they're trying to make lives better for laying hens. And then we saw it this year in November when in Massachusetts, another ballot initiative passed, again, with overwhelming support, 78%, to create a requirement that any egg, pork, chicken, poultry of any kind sold in the state, that those animals had to come from housing arrangements that allowed them to stand up, turn around, stretch their wings, move more freely. And that passed. That got support. So you can really see over the last, like, since 2008 all the way through this year, just a massive amount of effort being put towards changing policies.
You follow the trajectory of this small clan of pragmatists, some of them working on changing policies. You just talked about lobbying policy, making inroads with investment banks, undercover investigations, and also founding a well-known eggless condiments company. So a number of different strategies. How is this pragmatic side of the vegan movement doing compared to the more, let's say, absolutists?
Right. So the interesting thing about this handful of people who really dug in 2000 and drove this movement is that you can really track the changes that they've been able to make as they've gone through this past 16 years. One of them just this year founded a lobbying institute in Washington, D.C. that represents the interests of sort of plant-based and meat alternative food products. Another one helps mastermind writing these ballot initiatives that are being put in front of voters across the country. Another one is talking to major investment banks here in New York, Morgan Stanley, ING, BlackRock, and trying to sort of convince people in the investment community and the finance community to care about animal welfare from a very sort of pragmatic financial perspective. Another one of them has gone on to really dig in and do sort of undercover investigations so that, in her view, that people know how animals are being treated on this farm level. And then, as you mentioned, yeah, that one of them has gone on to found Hampton Creek, which is a very well-known eggless condiments company. They have a product called Just Mayo that has gotten some notoriety through the years.
We're talking about a definitive split in the vegan movement that happened right at the beginning of this century and created two very divergent paths forward. Chase Purdy is with us. He's a New York-based journalist who writes about food for Quartz. I want to pick up on this idea of the Massachusetts ballot initiative because, you know, it just happened. 78% of the voters, as you said, supported that prohibition. Now, I imagine the kind of, you know, agitating that can be done by lobbyists or in back rooms. But that means the support of a number of voters, we're assuming a lot of them non-vegans. How did they pull that off?
Right. So a major part of the strategy for, you know, this sort of pragmatic vein of the movement is really appealing to people's sort of everyday sensibilities, in a lot of ways sort of the emotional side of how our food is produced in this country. That includes issues like, should piglets have their tails cut off without anesthesia, or should an egg-laying hen or a pregnant pig, a sow, be crammed into a cage where they can barely move? And, you know, what I have learned from the people who are driving this movement and what they say that they are hearing is that, you know, by and large, people don't want to be eating food that comes at the expense of animal suffering. And at least in the Massachusetts example, 78% of the voters on Election Day supported that ballot measure. So they seem to be able to really be convincing people that this is the future, that there will be specific standards for the husbandry practices from where their food comes from.
Well, that's also Massachusetts, you know, a notably liberal state. And if we can divide, you know, food production in the Midwest, in Texas, in California, there are these huge farms and the scale is so much bigger than places like Massachusetts. What difference does a small state like that actually make in egg production, for example?
So that's sort of what makes this ballot effort so interesting on the part of the Humane Society, is that they have really found a way to change the system without appealing directly to the food companies that are responsible for producing a lot of the food that's in this country. They have figured out that if they can go into urban areas and appeal to a great number of people, they can basically change the food system from outside the heartland where food is made. So, for instance, in Massachusetts, there are about 6.7 million people in Massachusetts. There aren't a lot of egg farms. But if Massachusetts residents are willing to support a measure that says we're not going to buy eggs or pork or chicken that came from animals that couldn't be caged, then a farmer out in Iowa really has to make a decision. If I want to tap into that huge market on the East Coast, then I'm going to have to change my practices here in Middle America. And that's sort of really that's the tactic that's being used here. And for now, it appears to be working.
Chase, this pragmatic model that was kind of championed by these seven dissidents from the vegan movement, lobbying, corporate culture, you know, investment, working on ballot initiatives, that's a pretty high bar for a lot of activist movements. Do you think it's something that is replicable?
So I think that the answer to that question really is sort of left to be seen here. It was actually kind of interesting that as I was finishing up this story, that it kind of coincided with the election. And, you know, you see it on social media, you hear it on the streets. There are a lot of people in this country that are talking about how they can create change, how they can start movements. And it would not surprise me if there are lessons to be learned in this specific movement story, in the vegan movement story. Is it perfectly replicable? Probably not. But it certainly is proof that in many cases, striving strategically for incremental change in the right zones can be a very effective method to spark change and to gather a following along with it.
How about that popular image of vegans throwing red paint or chaining themselves to farm posts? Is that outdated?
So that's sort of beyond my scope of expertise in this area, for sure. I think that those movements definitely have played a role in drawing attention to an issue. I think a lot of those people who do prescribe to those methods have a really deeply held conviction for why they are doing that. In terms of whether or not that drives the most actual change, I think that that's sort of what's debatable here. And I think that sort of this pragmatic movement within veganism shows, or at least offers a pretty compelling example, that there is a better way to approach people. One of those pragmatists that I talked to, her name was Mayun Park, you know, she used to be in that movement. She was one of those people, and she told me that she used to lock herself to anything and everything she could, that she screamed like I wouldn't believe, that she even got arrested so many times. And she said she loved it, and she misses it because there's nothing like feeling that you're 100% right. But then she sort of added that when she looks back now, she feels like she sort of messed up because she thinks of all the people that she maybe turned away by acting like that. And I think that that is an interesting point that she makes. And I think that serves kind of as an example that perhaps that absolutist movement isn't going to serve or make the most change, even if it is drawing attention.
Chase Purdy, he's a New York-based journalist who writes about food for quartz. Thank you for speaking with us.
No, thanks for having me.
You can read his article about the two divergent vegan movements. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When you go from a walk to a jog to a run, what is actually happening? Is one just a faster version of the other? A small group of biomechanists says no. Once you get moving, it's another thing altogether. In this next piece from the podcast SIFT, host Bishop Sand walks us through some research that explains just what happens to our bodies when we pick up the pace.
Running started in 1972.
Well,
I mean, people ran, obviously.
In the 1970s, the United States started running.
About 1972, 73, 74.
The 1972 Olympic Games in Munich drew huge TV audiences.
Because of the terrorist attacks of the Israeli athletes.
There were 11 hostages. Two were killed in their rooms. Nine were killed at the airport tonight. They're all gone.
Frank Shorter of the United States has a real chance in this race.
And
American Frank Shorter won the Olympic marathon that year.
So that was pretty key. So a lot of people watched the Olympic marathon who might not in today's world.
At first, it was seen as a fad, but there was ever-increasing evidence that running helped boost cardiovascular health, weight loss, and had psychological benefits. Running icon Steve Prefontaine.
Prefontaine of Oregon, perhaps the United States' greatest distance runner.
Helped boost popularity.
Also,
a track coach from the University of Oregon.
A guy named Bill Bowerman.
Wrote books on the subject and co-founded the shoe company Nike.
Bringing running to the United States on the West Coast. And
running became mainstream.
People just started exercising, started jogging, and started running, and it became popular.
Just to give a sense of the boom in popularity, in 1960, the Boston Marathon only had 197 entrants. Today, it's over 30,000.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Scientists became fascinated with running as well, and a brand new field called biomechanics studied it.
So there were zero biomechanists, and then all of a sudden there were 10, and then there were 20 and 40. And I got in on the ground floor.
I'm Bishop Sand. On the show today, you'll be hearing from this guy.
I'm
Professor Roger Crom.
Associate Professor of Integrative Physiology at the University of Colorado Boulder.
We'll be taking a look at how we've changed our understanding of running in this episode of SIFT.
To let us see, in detail, the peculiarities of style, the dynamics of footstrike. And at Nike, we're putting that knowledge to work. Making shoes that actually help athletes to run faster and safer. Why do we go to so much trouble? Well, it may be the 20th century and all that, but there are still people out there who run as if their life depended on it.
The first real attempt at describing running was in the 1920s by a guy named A.V. Hill.
His name was Archibald Vivian, so I think I would go by A.V. also if I was... But amazing guy, really a Renaissance man. And he was a runner himself, and then he became a Nobel Prize-winning physiologist.
He thought the body moved like a machine.
And that there are these reciprocating parts.
Right now, it's helpful to envision someone running.
When we run, we bounce off the ground and then swing the other leg forward at the same time.
This happens like a reciprocating machine. Going over and over.
Bounce, swing, bounce, swing, bounce, swing.
And over again.
Bounce, swing. And he analyzed it using what you would do for a machine. If you had a steam engine or something like that, you would measure the work that was done, and you would relate that to how many buckets of coal you had to burn in order to make the machine do that.
Let's pause right here. Because this calculation is really important to understanding running. The work required to run, it's the force applied over a distance in order to
lift and lower the center of mass, to accelerate and decelerate the center of mass in the forward and backwards direction, and to move or swing the legs relative to the center of mass. All that mechanical work combined, that would be in the numerator in the top.
And you divide this work by
a physiological energy that you measure by how much oxygen the person or animal is consuming.
And as a result, you would get a percent efficiency.
It's a pure number. Mm-hmm. And that all made sense until it's remarkably late, but I would pin it at about 1973, 1975.
This is when the biomechanists brought in kangaroos.
A guy named Richard Taylor and his postdoc then was Terry Dawson from Australia. He brought the kangaroos to Boston.
What are the kangaroos like?
They're shy. People think they're very dangerous because they've watched a Bugs Bunny cartoon. That's been a very influential cartoon about kangaroos. you can sort of steer them from the tail and encourage them, you know. And they also just like to hop, so it's not terribly difficult.
They were studying these kangaroos because they're so efficient.
When kangaroos hop faster, they don't use energy more rapidly. They're just cruising along. They're bouncing off the ground. They recycle the mechanical energy with each step. And we suddenly realized that tendons were springs and not rigid, like bone-like structures. That's what's in all the textbooks until about 1973, 75. And then all of a sudden you start to realize that the tendons act like springs.
This completely changes how we think about running.
So if the tendons act like springs and you're just bouncing, then the muscles can just generate an isometric or a near isometric force.
The force required to stay in place.
It's like standing on a pogo stick with straight legs.
And this means that it takes less energy from our muscles to move around. We're just storing and reusing our energy through our tendons. This is revolutionary to the study of running. Because now we know
it's not the work, the force times distance that the muscles are doing, but rather just the force that they're generating and how much muscle is activated in order to generate that force that allows your tendons to act like springs and bounce off the ground. It's like if I took a super ball, it bounces more than once, right? But I only had to do work on the ball once to pick it up from the floor and then release it and it bounces. The energy was recycled using this elastic mechanism. Yeah. So it costs money. It costs energy to run. When we run, we generate remarkably high forces with our muscles. You know, 1,000 pounds in my calf. I do that 3 times a second, right? I'm not doing work, but I have to turn on my muscles, allow my springs to stretch, store the bounce energy, and recoil, and then take the next step and do the same thing.
To illustrate the shift of how we conceive of running, consider walking. For me, like a lot of people, like I guess, I think of running as just a faster version of walking.
But they're two fundamentally different things. In my mind, it's as different as riding a bike and running. They're that different.
And the difference being more of like just like the muscles being more, or your body acting more like elastic.
Yes, exactly. That walking is a series of collisions with the ground that we try to smooth out as best we can. But running is rather than a collision, it's a bounce. There's no real bounce in walking.
And that piece came to us from the podcast Sift, produced by Bishop Sand. Thanks so much for spending some of your Thanksgiving weekend with us. We hope we left you with some good food for thought. Earlier in the show, I spoke to the James Beard Award-winning cookbook author Kathy Gunst about how she and a group of friends found comfort and upped their culinary game by swapping soup. And now it's your turn to help transform Thanksgiving leftovers into a hearty, nourishing bowl of goodness. What is your go-to turkey soup recipe? Which ingredients really make it shine? You can let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or email us, wordofmouth@nhpr.org. Music in this episode came to us from Poddington Bear, David Seste, Night Auditor, and Franco Luzzi. If you missed any of today's show, fear not. You can listen anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or in Google Play. I'm Virginia Prescott, feeling mighty grateful. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.